You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Early this morning, volunteers dispersed all over the San Gabriel and San Fernando Valleys to count the number of people experiencing homelessness. Over the next 2 days, they'll cover all of LA County in an annual tally that helps the federal government determine how much funding should go into addressing homelessness. Now, Los Angeles chose to skip it last year due to the pandemic. The year before, they counted about 66,000 unsheltered people. Today on Greater LA, as the homeless count gets going, we're going to focus on young people experiencing homelessness, those folks under the age of 24. In the year 2020, the LA Homeless Services Authority, or LHASA, counted more than 4,000 kids and young adults as homeless, 4,673 to be exact. But turns out that number doesn't even begin to come close to the real problem. KCRW's Catherine Barnes is here with me right now to explain. Hey, Catherine.
Hey, Steve.
You have been looking into a different count here that uses a broader definition, right, of homelessness. What is that definition?
Yeah, so for their annual count, LHASA defines a homeless youth as someone who's living on the streets, in a car, a homeless shelter, or a motel. That's what brings them to that 4,600 number. But if you also count kids who are in unstable housing, that number catapults up to 51,287.
Wow. So unstable housing, 51,000. That's more than 10 times the number counted by LHASA. Where does that number come from?
So that number comes from LA's public schools. They keep track of this as well because unstable housing affects a student's ability to learn and do well in school. And schools don't want bad housing to turn into learning loss. Public school systems around the country started counting these kids after the McKinney-Vento Act was signed into law back in 1987. It was named after two U.S. congressmen who were working on poverty issues. And by the way, this was around the same time that the concept of homelessness was really starting to be understood as a systemic problem. And these congressmen realized that children who are homeless or in unstable housing need extra help, and schools are often the best place to help them.
Yeah, that's pretty much where it lands a lot of the time. So when you say, Catherine, unstable housing, what exactly are you talking about? I mean, like having a hard time paying rent or going, you know, bouncing from place to place?
Yeah, right. More like not being able to pay rent at all. I mean, for example, it could include, like you mentioned, a family who's temporarily couch surfing at a friend's place or a sister's house, somebody who's sharing an apartment with several other families because they can only afford part of the rent. That's often called doubling or tripling up. Or it could be a family who's renting a garage or some type of substandard housing that doesn't have electricity or running water, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, the true sense of unstable housing. I mean, but these schools, Catherine, they can't help secure housing for 51,000 kids and their families, right? I mean, that seems a bit out of their wheelhouse. So what can they do, Catherine?
Yeah, I was curious about that, too. So I asked Jennifer Kotke about that. She's the homeless education coordinator at the LA County Office of Education. And she agreed they can't fix housing, but they can do a lot of other stuff.
Districts, you know, purchase bike helmets to help kids who are riding to school. Lots of school supplies, tons of hygiene products, laundry detergent, you name it, you know, anything we can do to ensure that students are in school. And again, student-based. So it's not, we're not purchasing, you know, clothing for parents. It's all student-focused.
And these students, they're often called McKinney-Vento students based on that 1987 act. They also get free breakfast and lunch. They can get special transportation to school if their family had to move farther away, homework help, perhaps more time on tests. See, schools can be a pathway out of poverty, right? Or at least they're meant to be. So teachers and homeless coordinators are trying to do whatever possible to keep that student coming to school every day. Here's how Denise Miranda puts it. She's LAUSD's Director of Student Support Programs.
I think McKinney-Vento is more preventative in terms of if we were to address those students and families now, we would hope to prevent them from continuing having generational issues with housing.
So she's talking about breaking that cycle of poverty by setting that kid up for success. And sometimes that can come down to something as simple as clean clothes and free breakfast when they get to school.
All right. Well, speaking of free breakfast, Catherine, how did COVID affect those 51,000 homeless students? I mean, especially when everything went virtual, they couldn't get breakfast through a computer.
Yeah, it was really rough. I mean, the pandemic has been hard for all students, I would argue, but especially kids who depend on their schools for things like food, for internet, for supervision, for support. I'm sure you remember school districts scrambling to set up food drives, laptop distributions, get people internet access if they didn't have it. I mean, a lot of these McKinney-Vento kids straight up stopped coming to virtual classes. And Jennifer Cocky says, we failed these kids by closing schools.
We have lost a lot of students this past year because we cannot locate them. Largely, we think the contribution to that is the closure for districts. And then they implemented a lot of online enrollment systems, which were extremely difficult for our families to navigate. And then on top of that, just finding people to help them enroll, it was a nightmare.
And actually, the fact that it's been so hard for families to enroll their kids in school, Cocky thinks that means the homeless number this year is way larger than what they actually counted.
So they think 51,000 is an undercount?
Yeah, the school counts these kids when parents enroll or re-enroll their student in school. That's when they're asked to fill out this housing survey. So if the student doesn't enroll, the parent doesn't fill out the survey, and the kid doesn't get counted. And even if they do enroll, Denise Miranda from LAUSD told me that parents were more wary this year of telling the truth on that housing survey.
Housing may not necessarily be one of those items that they're going to disclose to the school because they're dealing with trauma, they're dealing with, you know, loss of jobs, obviously the illness given the pandemic. So we've noticed a decrease in the number of students identified, yes.
And she told me that some parents also fear that if they disclose that they live in substandard housing, that DCFS or child welfare will come in and remove their child, which Miranda assured me is not the case.
Wow. So, all right. The number of homeless students in LA County is likely way more than 51,000. And I can't help, Catherine, but think about those students' families. I mean, if tens of thousands of students are in unstable housing, right? That's the word, unstable. Say they're living with at least one parent or guardian, if not two, and maybe they have a sibling who isn't enrolled in school yet. I mean, that means there are hundreds of thousands of people who are not included in this week's point in time count, right? The loss account, but arguably just as in need of housing solutions, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, reporting on this story made me realize that there's this huge, often hidden population of people that are on the brink of homelessness. And that's often where street homelessness starts, right? It's not like you go from having a plush three-bedroom apartment to living in your car. You fall down the rungs of a ladder. And those are the people who often go unseen and uncounted. Here's Miranda from LAUSD again.
Obviously, the HUD definition is very narrow, and it doesn't take into account the situations that our families are dealing with. Again, mental health issues, the poverty, obviously, specifically living in Los Angeles, those neighborhoods that have community violence, the food instability. So I think, unfortunately, it's a large gap of children and families that HUD is not capturing.
Catherine, it is LASA. I mean, these are the homeless services folks, right?
Yeah.
Is LASA aware of this giant elephant in the room? I mean, that the numbers that they're counting right now don't quantify, not even close, quantify the true scope of the problem.
They are. And you know, the agencies are starting to talk to each other a little bit more. The good news is LASA and the schools have been working a lot more closely on this problem ever since Measure H passed in LA back in 2016. That measure secured some money that helped create a coordinated system between the school system and LASA, where the schools can refer families who are at risk of losing their housing, and LASA can hopefully help them find solutions. In other words, they're trying to stop families from falling all the way down that ladder into literal homelessness. And at the end of the day, it doesn't necessarily matter which definition of homelessness a child fits under, as long as they get counted somewhere, because if they don't, no one's there to help.
They, as it were, fall through the cracks, right?
Right.
Yeah. KCRW's Catherine Barnes taking a deep dive into youth homelessness data here in Los Angeles. Catherine, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, if you're having trouble paying the bills or maybe in unstable housing, then perhaps you can't afford a car or the increasingly high price of gas to run it. Now, biking is an option, but how do you do it safely on the busy streets of Greater LA? One group wants to help.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy.
Oh, baby, have it now.
Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
John Jones III founded the Eastside Riders back in 2008. It's a bike club that provides bike riding safety classes. They hold events for kids and families. And once a month, club members actually ride out and feed the homeless, providing even more help for the community. And John Jones joins us right now. Hey, John.
Hey, Steve. How are you doing today?
I'm all right. 14 years you've been doing this. How'd you get started?
Yeah, so Eastside Rider started with an idea from my father. He wanted to have a bike club, but his idea of a bike club was a little different from where we are today. He wanted to bring bikes out into the park, barbecue, show off some bikes. I remember when I was a kid, my mom used to always have us going out, finding folks in the community, having breakfasts in our front yard, feeding the homeless, doing shoe boxes for Christmas, backpacks for kids to go back to school. And I told my dad if we was going to do this bike club, we needed to incorporate some of the things that my mom had us doing as a kid into this organization so we can have an impact on some lives for years to come.
I mean, biking on LA streets, I've done it, and it's difficult. Drivers don't see you oftentimes. I mean, what goes into all of that, trying to make sure that people stay safe?
So 14 years ago, when we first got on the streets of Watts, Los Angeles, South LA, we found out that it was very difficult. We had cyclists riding the wrong side of the street, the wrong way. We had drivers honking at us because they wanted us to get off the road, wanted us to get on the sidewalk. And, you know, we just had a difficult time. So we learned that there was ways to not only teach people, kids and adults, how to ride a bike safely on the street, but to also bring drivers out of their cars and take some of these bicycle safety classes. So then when they are driving their cars, they know what to look out for. And we created our BEAST class, Bicycle Education and Safety Training.
You want drivers to take the class as well. Talk about that, because that sounds a little unconventional, right? You want the drivers to understand that there are bicyclists on the road as well.
Yeah, we just thought that, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, well, these rules are in your driver's handbook. You know, you when you take your driver's test, the rules are there and they let you know that cyclists have a right of way to the road. But it's a little different when you pull people out of their cars for a couple of hours and actually put them on the bike so they can get the feel of what's going on when they're in a car. And then we tell them what to look out for when they're riding their bike. So then it can translate to when they're driving their car, they're looking out for those same things. You know, left turn, right turn, you still have to do those signals when you're riding your bike. You still have to look both ways when you're riding your bike. You have to take, you know, the right side of the road, and you have the opportunity to take the lane. So if we're teaching drivers that when they're sitting down in these classes and they get out here and they feel the same thing that they're putting out, it kind of changed their driver pattern and make them look out for cyclists when they're driving down the street.
And you do rides to feed the homeless, as I mentioned in the intro. I mean, you just had one over the weekend, right? Tell us a little bit about what you do for, you know, in that regard, feeding the homeless.
Yeah, one of the first things that we did when we started this organization, and it was a lot different than we do it today, but we went out and we grabbed some bags of ice, some grocery bags, put waters in these bags and hung them on our handlebars. We made sandwiches with the full spread on there with chips and everything, and rode out through the community for hours. At that time, we was looking for where our homeless population was. We wanted to make sure we stayed in the communities that we lived in and serve the homeless in our communities. We didn't want to go out to downtown where we know, you know, services are there, people can walk in the doors. Nowadays, yeah, we do the same thing, but we don't make the sandwiches all the way. We put the bread and the cheese and the meat together, but we have mustard and mayonnaise packages that we throw in there so they can put them on. Some people don't like mayonnaise, some people don't like mustard. They can put whatever they want on there. And we still go out with waters, juices, snacks. I mean, it just got a little bit better than when we first started. it's a little more coordinated. We know exactly where we're going. We know the routes. And to be honest, from 14 years ago to now, our homeless population has probably quadrupled.
Yeah. I want to ask you about a recent story in the LA Times, which found that a lot of cyclists in low-income neighborhoods of color, particularly, are being stopped by sheriff's deputies and often being held and searched. Does that story ring true to you? I mean, is it something that you and the people, you know, you work with have experienced?
Well, I mean, 14 years ago, that was true. That was true. Nowadays, we don't see much of that. But just take you back to maybe about 8 years ago, it was a cyclist killed in Gardena. And our organization was riding out to, you know, try to bring light to cyclists being killed. We teamed up with the family, and we was riding out to City Hall in Gardena. And we was pulled over by Gardena police, maybe 20, 30 police cars, and it was 10 of us there. They cited 9 out of 10 of us. The only one they did not cite for impeding traffic and blocking the road was the daughter of the guy that was killed in the collision. We took that and we didn't stand still. We continued to push on that issue. Why was we stopped in the first place? We was all riding our bikes. We wasn't impeding traffic. It was 2 lanes. Cars can go around us. We wasn't, you know, if it was 1 lane, it's a different story. We have to make sure we stay as much as we could to the right and just make sure that we was riding safely. We can't ride on the sidewalks, so that's not an option, which the cops was telling us we need to ride on the sidewalks. We told them that's not possible. We're not supposed to ride on the sidewalks. Fast forward, you know, we got all of the tickets dismissed. We had the whole Gardena Police Department go through training with the Los Angeles Bicycle Coalition and the California Bicycle Coalition. We pushed to have Gardena Police Department go through training and update their laws, right? They still had rules that was dating back way before cycling became more popular than it is. And every city around them had updated their laws, but Gardena. And that was something of what you're talking about. It was a tool used to pull over people who was just going back and forth to either work or to school. It was a tool, you know, stop and frisk. And I think it's gotten better over the years. We know that it's still happening in low-income communities, and that's why we're here. We're here to try to help change that agenda, do work with the police departments, and show them that people, as regular folks, going back and forth to work, going back and forth to the store. This is their main mode of transportation. You know, you can't continue to harass people for their transportation.
Well, I want to thank you for all that you do for the community, and especially for bike riders all throughout Greater LA. John Jones III, founder of the East Side Riders Bike Club. John, thanks for your time. Thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, thank you for having us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotakis here. As LA County begins its count of unhoused people this week, so too do the folks of OC. Orange County is expecting its count to be higher than its last official one. And here in LA, the unhoused crisis is among the top concerns as the race to replace Mayor Eric Garcetti heats up this year. Weighing in on LA's handling of homelessness landed Gustavo Arellano in the middle of a well, let's call it a little social media frenzy. He likes to stay there, by the way. Gustavo's a columnist for the LA Times and a regular here at GLA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Or as you're called on Twitter, Colonel Gustavo Arellano.
Yes, sir.
During this last Super Bowl, you did go on Twitter, never how you want to begin a story, by the way, these days, and you tweeted about an aerial shot of the pristine Echo Park Lake that was broadcast during the Super Bowl. What happened after that?
Oh, I just mentioned where, if this shot was going to show the fence that was erected around Echo Park last May after the city pushed out the homeless encampment there. It was a simple question, but oh my Lord, all these people started saying, yeah, it should be there. And they started throwing all these assumptions on me as if I thought that homelessness was okay, that I thought that people living in feces was okay, that I thought all sorts of things. And so after that, and you know, you go on Twitter, you mute people, then you see who these people are. And what shocked me was that a lot of the people on their bio, on their Twitter bio, on their timeline, they were Democrats. They were self-identified progressives, good liberals, and they had stuff. They were spewing rhetoric that seemed straight out of Mission Viejo down in Orange County.
Were you surprised by the reaction you got? I mean, LA's always had a reputation of being a bit of a NIMBY-ish place, and obviously having many people living in a major city park isn't ideal either, right?
No, of course not. But I figured that the people, you know, from Orange County, from my vantage point in Orange County, I always hear those debates going out in, like, say, the San Fernando Valley on the west side, where you have people, even though they say they're liberals, they're really, you know, conservatives, the ultimate NIMBYers, richer folks. But coming from Echo Park, coming from place, I mean, we're talking about people with roses on their bio, roses being the code for being a democratic socialist, and just coming out with this NIMBYism. That's what really surprised me. And couple that with a report that my colleagues at the LA Times wrote about how it seems the entire city is angry about the mayoral election. And then you bring in Rick Caruso. I'm like, oh, you watch. The so-called liberals might be the swing vote in this mayoral election, whereas most people would think Karen Bass would have a shoe-in. Congresswoman Karen Bass would easily go in. Maybe the liberals are going to do something else.
Well, let's underscore like 20,000 times that you're painting with a broad brush, right?
Of course. That's what a columnist does.
Not everybody feels this way. Right, exactly. So I just want to reiterate that. In the Times today, though, this was your columna today. You write that the backlash to your tweet reveals a connection between current LA city politics and Orange County, which is what you just said. And I want to give you a couple of quotes from that columna, if you will. Quality of life issues, quote, have been voter catnip in my Orange County homeland for generations. What do you mean by that? Is that the NIMBYist stuff?
It's code for we don't want to be LA. It's code for, I mean, it's not even code anymore. District Attorney Todd Spitzer, that's his hashtag for this his reelection campaign, hashtag no LA and OC. This idea that, above all, property values are sacrosanct. We must fight everything, whether it's minorities coming into your neighborhoods, whether it's homeless folks, whether it's too many people living in one house. So that's most importantly, quality of life above all.
The LA mayoral primary is coming up in June. Now, obviously, most of the candidates that are considered front runners are Democrats. Do you think the backlash is foreshadowing anything about this upcoming election? I mean, you say that there are a lot of folks who, you know, maybe Karen Bass isn't the shoe, and maybe the progressive stance isn't the shoe. I mean, what do you think this foretells of what's to come?
The fact that Rick Caruso, a billionaire developer, is jumping into the race and thinks he has a chance to win. Look, billionaires do not like to waste money. That's how they became billionaires. So Caruso really thinks he can get enough voters. Obviously, he'll get all the conservatives, the few conservatives left in Orange County, or rather in Los Angeles County, the few Republicans. There's still a lot of people who might be in the middle of the road, but this is what I've just been seeing so many liberals, and just talking to my own friends. We're talking about dyed-in-the-wool progressives, just frustrated with Garcetti, not excited at all about Bass and Kevin DeLeon or Mike Feuer or Joe Buscaino. And now they're saying, like, oh, we need someone to rescue us. It's literally sounding like doom and gloom Los Angeles, Gotham. And I've never bought that narrative about Los Angeles being as messed up as people have been saying it has been for the past 25 years. But I'm hearing it now more than ever. And again, I'm hearing it from people who would identify as left.
There was a similar situation, by the way, a couple of years ago. Y'all in Orange County near Angel Stadium, right? Unhoused people living along the Santa Ana River were moved out, fences erected. I mean, what was the impact there?
Oh, yeah. Quickly. I mean, and this is the thing. The homeless encampment next to the Santa Ana River was three times bigger than what happened in Echo Park. That existed in Echo Park Lake. They put that fence, and it's no longer there. But the folks who were there, the unhoused people, they just went into other neighborhoods. And so that was the ultimate warning I had for liberals in Los Angeles who might want to get a little bit more reactionary. It's like, it's not enough to just side with someone who says, I'm going to disappear all these people, or just get angry about it, because that's Orange County's response. And what's going to happen with Orange County tonight? All this week, we're going to have that point in contact census, if you will, of the homeless population in Orange County. The numbers are probably going to be bigger than ever before, because Orange County politicians, they talk a big talk on ending homelessness, but really their idea of ending homelessness is let's dump them in Santa Ana. And that's not a solution.
All right, we're going to have to end it there. Gustavo Arellano from the LA Times. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
That's it for us this evening. Thanks for being here. Tomorrow, as pandemic becomes endemic, how should California react moving forward? I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears and time. Have a great night.